Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
With DoorDash, you can now get even more delivered to your door. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With $0 delivery fees on your first order. Get more from your neighborhood delivered with DoorDash. Terms apply. Visit DoorDash.com.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday, the 6th of April, these are our main stories. France's president on a state visit to Beijing calls on China's leader to bring Russia to its senses over the war in Ukraine. China moves its warships close to Taiwan after a high-profile visit to the US by the Taiwanese president. There's alarming new research about Antarctica's melting ice sheet. Also in this podcast...
It is quite a huge task, quite nerve-wracking, but it's also an honour to serve this country.
A historic moment for Zambian women in tech. And we start this podcast in Beijing. A Chinese military band played the French national anthem and there was a 21-gun salute as France's President Emmanuel Macron was welcomed with full honours by his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping on a state visit, the latest in a series by European leaders. Mr. Macron used his talks with Mr. Xi to urge him to use his influence with Russia to help bring an end to the war in Ukraine.
To speak of this beneficial strategic partnership between our two countries is obviously to speak of peace and stability in the world. We are attached to it, and I know that you are attached to respect for the United Nations Charter, to the strict compliance with the texts that apply to the nuclear field, and therefore to everything that allows peace and stability on the planet. And in this respect, the Russian aggression in Ukraine has struck a blow against this stability. It has put an end to decades of peace in Europe. And I know that I can count on you, under the two principles that I just mentioned, to bring Russia to its senses and everyone to the negotiating table.
Mr. Macron's visit comes as relations between the West and the world's second biggest economy have soured in recent years. He's being accompanied by the European Commission chief, Ursula von der Leyen. After bilateral talks between the two men, the three then held a joint meeting, sitting around an extremely large table. This is what Ms. von der Leyen said in that meeting.
The European Union and China today have extensive and complex relations. How we manage these relations will be a determining factor for our future economic prosperity. This is why I do not see decoupling from China as a viable or desirable strategy, but equally I do see a number of risks that Europe needs to address.
Our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow, told us Ms. von der Leyen seemed to be playing bad cop to Mr. Macron's good cop in dealing with China.
There's a slight difference in tone by the two European leaders. President Macron, slightly more flattering towards his host, suggesting that he has influence in Moscow to stop the war in Ukraine. He certainly does have that influence. But Ursula von der Leyen then later on, who joined the meetings, she struck a kind of slightly more strident tone, warning that there are big differences between Europe and China. And while she doesn't want to see a kind of decoupling, which is a thing that the United States is talking about at the moment, she did see difficulties in the road ahead between in their relationship. So a slightly different attitude shown by those two leaders.
And I was watching these talks on the television and I just couldn't help but be struck by how enormous the table was that they were sitting around.
Yeah, big table. I mean, we're used to seeing President Putin sat at one side of a big table when he meets people as well. So, I mean, it is usual. It's awkward. There were three people here, so they had to get somewhere to show a relationship which didn't perhaps show which one was more important than the other one. But certainly that might as well be an indication of the kind of distance between the two sides. for people looking for meaning in tables, that's what they might be drawing from that.
Yeah, but a lot of people will be watching the tables there to see what symbolism can be drawn from that. But Mr. Xi also had a separate earlier meeting with the French president. What was discussed then?
Well, it was the war in Ukraine that was the main issue which has come out there, as we've heard President Macron suggesting that China should bring Russia to its senses. A real strident and strong phrase that, interestingly, already Moscow has responded. A Kremlin spokesman has said that, well, poured water essentially on the idea that China should act as a mediator, suggesting war at the moment on fighting is the only way forward. So perhaps trying to neuter any kind of growing momentum that might build up for China to put pressure on Moscow to stop the fighting.
Because China does have warm relations with Russia, but it clearly also wants to have good relations with the EU and with France.
That's why China's in a difficult position, and it's in a difficult position of one of its own making, really, because it's allied itself and aligned itself quite clearly with Moscow over the last year. It hasn't criticised Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It's also given it some support. Xi Jinping visited Moscow just last month. So that really undermines the idea that China could act as an honest broker and a neutral party in any negotiations between Moscow and Kyiv.
Michael Bristow. Another sensitive issue for China's relations with the West is Taiwan, which Beijing claims as part of its territory. China puts a great deal of effort into discouraging other countries from fostering relations with a self-governing island. So it strongly condemned a meeting on Wednesday, which took place on US soil between the Taiwanese president, Tsai Ing-wen, and one of America's most senior politicians, Kevin McCarthy, the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Taiwanese officials say a Chinese aircraft carrier has been spotted off its coast, and they see this as China's direct response to that meeting. Shaima Khalil in Tokyo is monitoring developments.
Taiwan's defense ministry said that its warships are closely monitoring China's aircraft carrier, the Shandong, from about 5 to 6 nautical miles. We know from the defense ministry statement that the Chinese aircraft carrier passed through the Bashi Channel between Taiwan and the Philippines and then went on into Taiwan's southeastern waters. The defense minister said that while the carrier was in training, as we understanding, the timing is quite sensitive. And of course, the timing that he's referring to is that meeting between Taiwan's president, Tsai Ing-wen, and the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker, Kevin McCarthy. Ms. Tsai was on a stopover in California on her way back to Taiwan, and the meeting happened at the Ronald Reagan Library. It was quite a friendly meeting, and again, bolstering relations between Taiwan and the U.S. The rhetoric there from the U.S. and from Taiwan is one of friendship. Ms. Tsai said that it was good to know that Taiwan is not isolated. And of course, all of that angered China, who condemned the meeting. They said that the U.S. was on a wrong and dangerous road. And remember, of course, this comes at an all-time high tension between the U.S. and China, and at the time where China is receiving European visitors in Beijing.
Yes, very sensitive time. And Taiwan is quite wary of inflaming anger in China too much, because Kevin McCarthy had initially wanted to come to Taiwan like his predecessor, Nancy Pelosi, but Taiwan had judged it better for the meeting to occur in California between the Taiwanese president and the Speaker of the House of Representatives.
That's right. And it's a very fine balance that they're trying to strike. On one hand, Taiwan knows how important it is to keep those relationships between the self-governing island, between its government and the United States going. They want to show the world, and they want to show the Taiwanese people that they're not isolated, that they have the support of the United States. There are elections coming up in January, and I think Ms. Tsai, who cannot run for a third term, wants her party to go on and continue to govern. So there is that internal politics. But as you say, it is very, very sensitive and very tense.
Shaima Khalil. Israeli police have stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem for the second time in hours after raiding the compound on Wednesday and arresting hundreds of Palestinians despite widespread international condemnation. The site is holy to both Muslims and Jews, and tensions are high as the Jewish holiday of Passover and the Muslim holy month of Ramadan overlap this week. Palestinian militants in Gaza fired more rockets into southern Israel in response to these latest clashes. From Jerusalem, Lucy Williamson reports.
Video footage appears to show Israeli police entering the mosque while being pelted with objects from inside. Israel said its forces had successfully prevented people from barricading themselves in the building for a second night and had allowed worshippers there to leave. But the sight of Israeli police entering the third holiest site in Islam has provoked warnings of increased tension and instability from both the Palestinian presidency and militant groups. Yesterday, the Islamic custodians of the Al-Aqsa site, known to Jews as Temple Mount, called on Muslims to stay in the mosque overnight throughout the month of Ramadan to protect it from police and Jewish settlers, they said. A UN spokesman said that the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, had been shocked and appalled by the images of violence and beating inside the mosque on Wednesday. This should be a time for peace and not violence, he said.
Lucy Williamson. It's still unclear who was behind the explosion which killed the Russian pro-war blogger Vladlen Tasatsky in St. Petersburg on Sunday. But the Russian authorities have charged a 26-year-old woman with the killing. After the blast, Ukraine implied the blogger might have been killed because of an internal power struggle in Russia over its failures in Ukraine, and suggested Russians had become, quote, spiders eating each other in a jar. Tatarsky was one of Russia's war reporters, a loose but influential assortment of people who support the invasion of Ukraine, but not always the commanders running it. Vitaly Shevchenko has been looking at who they are.
The sound of Russian missiles being launched at Ukraine from one of countless videos posted by Russian war correspondents. Known as Voyenkory, they usually claim to have specialist military knowledge and access to Russian troops. Some are employed by Kremlin-controlled media, but others blog on social media, apparently without any links to any particular media outlet. Yuri Podolyaka is one of the most popular of such bloggers.
If the Ukrainian state still exists after the war in any shape or form, that would mean a defeat for us. That's why the only question is where Russia's border with Poland would lie. That's it.
The emergence of such bloggers after the initial invasion of Ukraine in 2014 heralded a new era of war reporting in Russia. For many of them, supporting the war does not necessarily mean supporting the top brass. Here's how Rybar, a Telegram channel with more than 1 million followers, reacted when the defense ministry stayed silent about a rapid Ukrainian counteroffensive in Kharkiv region in September last year.
Dear Defence Ministry, we know that you see this and many other Telegram channels which allow themselves to criticise the progress of the special military operation as traitors, provocateurs and fake news. You don't like us because we don't toe the party line. But now is not the time to stay silent.
And it's criticism like this of the military authorities that makes war bloggers stand out from the all-pervasive Kremlin-controlled propaganda. But prominent war correspondents employed by traditional pro-Kremlin media tend to be much more accepting of the official line. One of the most prominent of these is Alexander Kotz, who works for the Komsomolskaya Pravda tabloid and often reports from the front line. Responding to the killing of Vladlen Tatarsky, Kotz, similarly to Russian officials, pointed the finger of blame squarely at Ukraine.
Earth must be set alight under every Ukrainian functionary, regardless of whether they are wearing a uniform. These people must be destroyed.
Much of the content posted by war correspondents is extremely graphic. One of the most infamous examples is Grey Zone, which posted footage of the apparent murder of a traitor with a sledgehammer in November last year. Russian war reporters often call for the destruction of Ukraine as an independent state. For example, Yuri Kotynok has said the very Ukrainian identity must be destroyed.
Even cancer can be cured, but Ukrainianism? Never. It's a type of Satanism that can only be destroyed with one thing, fire, all-consuming fire that will cleanse this filth.
Kotynok has more than 400,000 subscribers on Telegram.
That report by Vitaly Shevchenko. Zambia's mining sector has made history by appointing its first female CEO to head one of the country's biggest mining operations. Mifike Mikeyi will head the copper unit for Cobalt Metals. The company uses artificial intelligence to identify battery metal deposits. President Hakainde Hichilieme tweeted the news with the hashtags Women in Leadership and Inspiring Women after congratulating her in his office. We heard from Mifike about what her appointment means to her.
It is quite a huge task, quite nerve-wracking, but it's also an honor to serve this country. This country is known as a mining country for many, many decades. And I think what we're trying to do is ramp up our copper production. The project is currently a mining project under exploration, but there are many more projects coming, greenfield projects that the artificial intelligence technology that we'll be using will be helping us find more deposits faster as we drive the renewable energy initiatives globally.
You are Zambian, proudly Zambian, but you've had connections both in the US and the UK where you also trained. And I just wonder what it means to you as a Zambian woman and what you think it means to others who may be now looking towards the mining industry that hasn't traditionally been a bastion of gender equality, if you like.
It's been, a 15-year journey. A small number in most of the long mining careers we are used to hearing about. But I started out on the floor in the mines of Northwestern Province at First Quantum's Kansanshi Mine and worked my way through those corridors and into, you know, the mining services. So I think it means a lot for people who enter this sector. It's a sector that's almost seen as in the corner somewhere, but it's pivotal to our economy. 70% of our exports is copper. So it means a lot for myself personally, my family, and I think the industry has been open to women. Contrary to belief, there are a lot of women in the Zambian mining sector. I think it's just bringing them to the world to see that there's a lot of women working in this sector. Even though the percentages are still low, there is a significant populace.
Mifike Mikeyi speaking to Bola Masuro. Famously shy and elusive, platypuses are only found in Australia, like the more familiar koala or kangaroo. But what would you do if you saw a platypus on your local train? Well, that's what happened to commuters near Brisbane. They did, in fact, find themselves travelling alongside a wild platypus. The man carrying it has now been arrested after allegedly stealing it from the wild and could face a fine of close to $300,000. Anna Murphy has the details.
Platypuses are semi-aquatic, egg-laying mammals. Their description is rather comical, sometimes being described as a duck's bill sewed onto a mammal's body. A 26-year-old man stole one of these animals from the wild in Australia and took him on a train from Murrayfield to Brisbane, carrying it in a plastic bag. He even offered passengers around him the chance to pat the platypus. But those passengers would have been well advised not to touch the animal, as despite their harmless appearance, the spurs on their back feet are actually venomous. The platypus did not only pose a risk to the passengers around it, but was in fact in danger itself. The Queensland Environment Department stressed that the mammal was at risk of illness and even death if it was kept out of its natural habitat for long. The man who took him from the wild has been charged with stealing an animal that is classified as a protected breed and keeping it captive. Fortunately, the platypus was rescued and released into a nearby river, but police say they were unsure of its condition.
Anna Murphy. Still to come on this podcast. Super Mario makes yet another return.
Abnormal transactions.
Some kind of cyber attack on a bank.
Tens of millions of dollars.
Something I don't think anybody has seen before.
It's a cyber criminal group.
From the BBC World Service.
The Lazarus Heist is back for season 2.
It was really like in the movies.
Find out more at the end of this podcast.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. New research suggests Antarctica's melting ice sheet could be retreating much faster than previously thought. The evidence comes from markings on the seafloor off Norway. Dr. Christine Batchelor of Newcastle University is lead author of the study.
So in this study, we analysed a large area of the seafloor. We identified some landforms which we call corrugation ridges, which record how quickly the former ice sheet retreated, because they were formed when the ice sheet was retreating backwards, but also moving up and down on the tides. So if we know the spacing of the ridges, and we know that one ridge is produced each low tide when the ice sheet sits down, this allows us to calculate the retreat rate in the past.
And it's a lot higher.
Yes, up to 600 metres per day, which is around 20 times faster than even the highest rate of ice sheet retreat that we've seen over the satellite record so far.
Dr. Christine Batchelor speaking to my colleague Nick Robinson. Our science correspondent Jonathan Amos told us more about the significance of these latest findings.
Well, we've learnt just how quick an ice sheet can go into reverse, the margin of that ice sheet, how quickly it can go backwards. Now, we study Antarctica today using a fleet of satellites. They pass over every few hours and they measure the height of the ice, but they also measure the speed at which it flows as well. And the particular area that Christine Batchelor is talking about is this area they call the grounding zone. So when ice flows off the land, there's a point at which that ice becomes buoyant and it lifts up. And it's that zone, the grounding zone, that the satellites track the position of. And we can see some glaciers moving at 30 metres a day backwards, that grounding zone moving backwards as it melts. And we're talking here in the past of 600 metres today, up to 600 metres a day. So that is a 20-fold increase in speed, in reversal, in withdrawal of an ice sheet. So that tells us that what we're looking at today may not be the fastest that the Antarctic ice sheet can withdraw.
And so what does this mean for concerns about sea levels and global warming?
Well, at the moment, a lot of Antarctica is still very cold. It's very static. There are places where it snows quite heavily and the amount of mass being assembled on the Antarctic is increasing. But we do see at its edges, particularly in the west of the continent, that warm water is starting to get under the floating ice shelves there and erode them. And those glaciers are going into retreat. A glacier is always moving forwards, obviously, as it rolls off the land, but its front is being attacked and that is going backwards. Antarctica's contributed about a centimetre to global sea level rise since the 1990s. What we're waiting to see, what we're watching, is an acceleration in that contribution. And we can see by studying the surface of the oceans that that surface is rising. You know, a few years ago, it was about 3 millimetres per year. It's now about 4 or 5 millimetres per year. So Antarctica is making a contribution to that acceleration.
Jonathan Amos. Now, let's turn to the United States, where the number of so-called ghost guns recovered from crime scenes has risen by an incredible 1,000% since 2017. These guns are homemade, put together from a kit of parts or using a 3D printer, so they don't have serial numbers, making them untraceable. And they're sold online without background checks. Our New York correspondent, Neda Torfik, has been investigating.
Angelique. She was funny. She came out like me.
Manuel Yambo had never heard of a ghost gun until his daughter was killed by one, according to prosecutors. Angelie was one block away from her school when she and two other teens got caught in the crossfire of a gunfight. The suspect was 17 years old.
Angelie wasn't the target. It was somebody else. He didn't even hit the kids he was attending to shoot at. Shooting a gun and not even knowing how to point it. You would think that things like that, you can't just order it online, like if it was a toy.
That is not something that I take lightly when you bring that up to me. I wouldn't want that to happen to my kids. But it doesn't change what is true and what is real.
Lauren Kelly co-founded Polymer 80, the largest ghost gun manufacturer. He feels for Angelie's family, but despite data showing firearms are the leading cause of death for American children, he is against government regulation.
Violence and guns. They are oftentimes in certain situations related because that's an implement used. But violence is a thing unto itself. You can sit there and call these data points out all you want because you've created a new category. And the new category is called gun violence. And of course they had to do that because there are more guns than people in the United States.
It's a distinction Angelie's family does not make. She died just a few months after her 16th birthday, where she shared a special dance with her father. The family are now hoping to turn their personal tragedy into something positive, with a foundation in her name to prevent the loss of another child.
Neda Taufik reporting. In Indonesia, there are fears that a tribe that has remained isolated from the rest of the world could be wiped out by a massive project to produce nickel for electric car batteries. Indonesia hopes to become a major producer of the metal as countries ditch vehicles powered by fossil fuels for electric ones. The Honghana Manyawa, which means people of the forest in their own language, are one of the last nomadic hunter-gatherer tribes in Indonesia. We heard from Callum Russell from the rights group Survival International.
We estimate that there are around 3,000 Honghana Manyawa people in total, and that between 300 and 500 of them are uncontacted and have no contact with the outside world at all. These are the most vulnerable peoples on the planet. They rely entirely on what nature provides to them as a nomadic hunter-gatherer tribe, and without their rainforest, they will not survive. So we are extremely concerned about their fate, and as we are about the fate of all uncontacted tribes, it is a terrible irony that they now risk being wiped out entirely, having contributed nothing to climate change, in the name of a supposedly sustainable lifestyle for people buying electric cars thousands of miles away.
What are the authorities saying then about this mining project and the impact that it may well have on this tribe?
So unfortunately, the Indonesian government is really much pushing ahead with this project as much as they can in terms of the nickel mining. Their Indonesian president is very keen on encouraging Elon Musk to invest Tesla and to invest in the electric car market. And the mining companies are going ahead with it as well, despite having known about what's happening to the uncontacted members of the tribe. They're still going ahead with it. And we were extremely worried. I mean, we know from previous studies in the Amazon that 90% or even 99% of uncontacted tribal people can die, even just from disease when they are contacted. So we're very worried indeed.
So an awful lot of members of this tribe then have been in contact with outsiders. Have you been talking to them? What are they saying about this mining project?
Yes, they are extremely concerned. I mean, some of them have got contact, and even if it's not much contact, obviously we wouldn't contact the ones which are uncontacted. But the ones which have some contact with the outside world are extremely worried. I spoke to a man a few days ago from the Honghana Manyawa tribe. He told me he was extremely worried about his uncontacted families who were hiding in the forest, and he hopes that our campaign can stop the mining. I mean, they don't know what's going on, a lot of them. They're, imagine what it's like wandering through your homelands and seeing a big, you know, holes gashed out of the grounds where the rivers are being destroyed and forests are being destroyed. And it's really heartbreaking for them. They're losing their every way of life, and we're very concerned about them indeed.
Do the companies concerned here, briefly, do they know of this tribe's existence and the potential danger their project poses to them?
They do indeed. I mean, French mining company Eramet, which operates in the largest mining concession, they've known since 2013 that an uncontacted tribal people are living in this area, and yet they continue to mine on their lands. And they really should know better if they have any concern for sustainability or human rights.
Callum Russell speaking to Rob Young. Now, take a listen to this. That's a sound that's familiar to those of us who were around in the 1980s and 90s. Super Mario, the beaming Italian plumber with the big moustache and the star of many computer games for decades. Technology has changed beyond recognition in that time, but Mario has always moved on. And now fans around the world can watch a new film version of the old game. So, what is the secret to Mario's continuing appeal? We heard from technology journalist Louise Blaine and the video game editor of The Guardian newspaper, Keza MacDonald.
Mario was now, I think he's now 38. He arrived in arcades as Jumpman in 1985. And since then, you know, we've grown with him as we've grown with our love of video games. Mario has grown along with us, so he's always been there.
Yeah, he puts a smile on people's faces, Keza, doesn't he?
He certainly does. I think the wonderful thing about Nintendo these days is that it's become intergenerational. So those of us who grew up with Mario when we were kids are now playing Mario with our kids. And in the same way that you'd pass down a beloved children's book or you'd watch a Disney film together from, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, he's become one of those family mascots that just keeps on finding new life.
He's a curious character to have created, isn't he?
Yeah, he was based on Nintendo's landlord in America, who was an Italian-American guy. That's who he's named after. So he's kind of an accident. Like, he was designed because his moustache, his face and his hair and his hat and his overalls were all different colours, and that was easy to discern on a very blocky pixel screen in the 80s, and he's kind of evolved from there and become this beloved worldwide mascot.
Keith, the real question is whether your six-year-old liked the film.
As my six-year-old adored the film, he really did. I thought it was okay. I thought it really got like the exuberance and the visual wildness of Mario out there. It got the sense of fun. But yeah, I think like kids are the ones at whom this movie is aimed, really, and so it should be. Mario's always really been treasurable for children.
And Louise, the characters have grown as characters, haven't they? Rather than sort of just animated folk who whiz round a track and, in my case, fall off a lot of the time. They are personalities we get to know.
Yeah, absolutely. They are massive personalities. I mean, they're massive personalities that still don't say tremendously much. You know, we've not got full sentences coming from them like we do in the movie. But we almost don't need it because they're almost caricatures. They're larger than life that actually don't need to say tremendously much. But we know a lot about them. We know Luigi's terrified of things. We know of Mario's bravery. So I think, you know, we attach ourselves to these characters, even if they don't say things all the time.
Louise Blaine and Keza McDonald speaking with Nick Robinson. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Mike Hadley. The producer was Alfie Habershon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Donat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
Where does North Korea get the cash to fund its nuclear weapons program?
North Korea is nothing if it is not creative, clever, agile.
Well, according to U.S. investigators, cybercrime.
A cyber attack was on no one's radar.
The attacker had very good knowledge of banking systems.
Although the regime denies any involvement, evidence suggests that North Korea's hackers are getting better and better at doing it.
What they did was also quite sophisticated, not something anybody has seen before.
The Lazarus Heist, Season 2, from the BBC World Service.
I was put in handcuffs, both my feet bound and my hands, taken to an interrogation centre. We were genuinely very frightened.
Search for The Lazarus Heist, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.